Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
I'm Manny.
And this is your new Comics Wednesday episode for September 30th, 2020. And five Wednesdays in September this year. So when that happens, a lot of times publishers will use that final Wednesday to put out
one-shots
and annuals and play catch up with some late books and things like that. This week was no exception. Last week, you know, Manny wasn't able to join me. I covered 13 books. There were so many great books on stand last week. And I feel like if you're a comic publisher, why do you want to be on a, you know, releasing so many great books on the same Wednesday when it's crowded? Why would you not take some of those really good books and wait a week and put them out this week when, I got to be honest, it was a pretty weak showing, I feel like. But that being said, I have been reading a lot more new stuff, like right when it comes out. So I read almost every DC book that came out this week and probably half the Marvel stuff that's out today. So nothing blew me away from the big two. There's a couple of things that were okay, but there was an independent book that was spectacular. And we'll see if Manny and I agree on that. So let's start with Joker Warzone, which I have not had a chance to read. But I know that Manny checked it out.
Yes.
It has I'm behind on Joker Warzone. I keep wanting to get caught up. I did get caught up on Death Metal, but I'm still behind on Warzone. But I know Manny got a chance to read it, and it's got a ton of stories in it. It's 51 pages or so, 48 pages. So we have writers Joshua Williamson, James Tynan, John Ridley, Sam Johns. There's art from Guillaume March, Olivia Copiel, David LaFuente, James Stokoe, Laura Braga. We've got colors from Tomeu More, Matt Hollinsworth, Antonio Fabella, Hi-Fi. Letters from Clayton Cowles, Darren Bennett, Tom Napolitano, Gabriel Downey. Ben Oliver does a cover. There's a variant cover from Derek Chu as well. Tons of characters. There's Clown Hunter shows up, Punchline, obviously Batman, Joker, Poison Ivy. Spoiler, Luke Fox is there, Bane. So jam-packed, and I do want to get caught up, but I just haven't had the chance. But this was a one-shot they added to the Joker War later, just because James Tynan was talking about wanting to give some of the characters and some of the aspects of the story that he didn't have real estate for in the regular Batman title. He wanted a chance to focus on some of those, so that's why we've got this other one shot here with a bunch of different stories, highlighting some aspects of other things that are happening in the Joker War. So, like I said, I didn't get a chance to read it, but Manny did. What do you think, Manny? Is it worth picking up?
Definitely, it's worth picking up because all the stories. And I'm trying to think if there was one that didn't have that at the end, but all the stories are going to be relevant 2021. Every one of the stories in this book will be continued in 2021. The one with Clown Hunter was not advertised as something that was going to continue on. Not to say we're not going to see the character anymore, but by the end of that story, it just kind of came to a conclusion. The best story in this book has to be the first one, which is also previewed in the previews book and a lot of sites out there that previewed this title. And that was A Serious House by James Tynan. And pretty much it's a confrontation between Bane and the Joker. And it was fantastic. It took the level I felt of the Joker wanting to hurt Batman, Bruce Wayne, to another level. Just because of the way he condemns Bane and what that, the way he explained himself, and Bane can't do anything about it. He's tied up. He's actually having venom taken out of his body. And it was done really, really well. And I couldn't be more excited to see what they do with this in 2021. The other story I really enjoyed was the one shot for Clown Killer, which really man, he really made him look like quite the badass in the way that Punchline and the Joker actually bring in a kind of like a special unit to take him out. And I mean, he's just taking out clowns left and right. And so the book is about Clown Killer's confrontation with these clowns or thugs. You might want to ask them. there's even a really good, really bad joke that I know Jace would probably enjoy. It's like, where did you learn to shoot like that? Clown college? I was like, oh, that's bad, even for this book.
Clown Hunter. Sorry, that I think you said Clown Killer. Isn't his name Clown Hunter?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. Clown Hunter. I said it wrong. But yeah, like I said, really, and even so, that artwork by James Stoke on the clown, the book's called Clown Hunt. It's really different than anything that you really see in any DC book at the moment. It has more even like a Mad Magazine kind of feel. So, and I think it fit the story really, really well, because it kind of made the mask look a little bit more grittier and everything. And so it was really enjoyable. Overall, I thought it was really, really decent. John Ridley also had a good story with Lucius Fox and Luke Fox, with, you know, kind of the after effects of the toxin that he was submitted to by Punchline. So, I mean, just overall, I thought it was decent. I wasn't too sure. I don't know why the kind of more of like the teenage kid artwork that they did for the symbol by Joshua Williamson with Spoiler and Orphan was kind of I don't know, I just didn't, it was just so clean and just kind of cartoony, which is strange saying that because it's a comic book, right? But I didn't enjoy it as much, which is really weird. It was interesting because they come face to face with this character called the Hinge Master, who is a guy who supposedly trains the best henchmen, regardless of who you're gonna go work for. And that's something I haven't necessarily seen too much of. And I've always liked it when either, you know, Batman dresses up as henchmen for different groups, or you kind of see the day in the life of a henchman. I always think that those are fun stories. So, or something like this was kind of fun to get through. I felt like the Ivy story was a little forgettable. And so, I mean, overall, I thought it was a pretty solid book, just because of the fact that it kind of gives us a taste of what to expect in 2021 from Batman storylines.
Yeah, part of the reason that I didn't, like, I knew it was a bunch of, you know, different stories, different aspects of what's certain characters have been up to during Joker War, like Poison Ivy and such, but I'm behind in Joker War, so that's why I didn't read it. But hearing you talk about it, it sounds like you don't even need to necessarily be caught up on Joker War to read this and just enjoy it for what it is.
Not really, but you kind of do need context for the Clown Hunter one, just because of how frustrated Punchline and Joker are with him. And for the Joker and Bane story, you do need to know exactly what happens in the nearing end, the last few issues of City of Bane, because there's things that happened in those few comic books that Joker is very upset with Bane at, and to the point where it's going to lead into this story in 2021, which I'm very curious to see how that even would have unfold or play out, and then what role would even, if at all, Batman would take in that kind of story. It's something a little different, and I've never seen Bane threatened like that, so I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, and I totally get what you're saying about the David LaFuente art in the symbol story with Spoiler and Orphan, because it's not just the artwork, but it's also the color work. So, you know, the artwork is really clean, but it's got really thick lines. And yeah, it's very smooth artwork. There's not a lot of texture, so it does look very like like you expect to see like an all ages book, like right. Moon mm-hmm. or something. And the other thing about it is his figure work. He's using that style where their feet are kind of big,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I can't remember, there was like a line of Marvel toys where they were like little mini Marvel figures. They weren't action figures. They didn't move or anything. They came in two packs, but their feet were big. I wish I could remember the name of them, but that's kind of the style of art that he's using here. It's just very childish looking. And then the color work, the way the artwork is colored, which I can't blame the color artist, Gabriella Downey for choosing to color it like this, because it's kind of what the artwork is asking for, but it's very bright and primary. And again, there's not texture added with the color either. So it definitely seems like a kid's comic.
Right. Which is fine if it is, because yeah. I think Orphan and Spoiler would be good for like a kid's comic.
Yeah, it just seems strange to throw it in a Joker War.
I know.
book. So anyway, all right. So let's move on from Joker War Zone. Let me talk about the first book I'm going to mention. I'll start with Fantastic Four number 24. It's written by Dan Slott. We have art by Paco Medina, colors by Jesus Arbatov, and letters by Joe Caramagna. There is also a backup special bonus story included by Donnie Cates and Greg Land called Nexus War Thor. And this ties into the Fortnite, whole Marvel Fortnite thing right now. So I don't know if this comic is going to blow up because it's tying into Fortnite and tying into the Marvel characters that are showing up in Fortnite, or is it going to blow up because it's Donnie Cates' Thor, which has been like selling like hotcakes lately and going to second printings and blah, blah, blah. And people aren't going to be expecting this, right? Like they're going to show up at their comic shop and not have ordered it because it's Fantastic Four and they haven't been buying it. They've been buying Donnie Cates stuff and then realize, and then all of a sudden people find out, oh, hey, I need to pick this up because it ties into Donnie Cates Thor. And then all of a sudden there aren't enough copies because it didn't get ordered because people didn't realize. I have no idea. So I think either no one's going to buy it, it's going to be lowest selling issue of Fantastic Four ever, or it's going to be like $40 on eBay by the end of the day. I don't think there's going to be any kind of middle ground. So it'd be interesting to see as far as the story itself. So if any of you read the first issue of Dan Slott's Fantastic Four or the first arc, there was this running gag about Iceman, Bobby Drake from the X-Men, having been a member of the Fantastic Four at one point. And Human Torch is like, no, that's not the case. He never was, blah, blah, blah. Well, this is the story. Finally, we're getting the secret origin of when Iceman was a member of the Fantastic Four for a day. I guess if you've been enjoying Slott's Fantastic Four, you'll get a kick out of this. I dropped it because I just really wasn't enjoying it that much. And it was okay. It wasn't great. It wasn't terrible. I thought Paco Medina's artwork, I've seen him do better work. And it's not that he's lazy or phoning it in by any stretch of the imagination, but I feel like maybe Slott isn't really pushing him. What I was impressed with is the fact that he does illustrate the story in two different styles, because you know, you've got the story that's happening in modern day, and then when you flash back to early on in the Fantastic Four's run, when that day happened where Iceman joined them for a day, probably late 60s, early 70s, he does switch to an old school style, and Jesus Arbatov, the colorist, colors it a little differently, textures a little different. And so that's impressive that he's able to draw in two different styles. And the storytelling and transitions from panel to panel layouts, everything is great. And maybe it's just the fact that the modern stuff, he doesn't, like, just because of the way the story is, there isn't really anything for him to kind of show off, because it's just a bunch of talking and characters sitting around. All the action happens in the throwback scenes where he's using that different style and it's colored differently. And so that's kind of why I don't know. I hear Paco Medina, I'm used to being impressed, and I wasn't really impressed with this. So it was just okay. I did read it because I was curious about about that, about how Iceman was a member. It was a running gag when I was reading it. So, and then this Thor story, I mean, it's Thor, it's Donny Cates, it's Fortnite. It's kind of goofy. There's a bunch of other characters that show up. I don't play Fortnite. I don't know much about it, to be honest, other than it's like this huge mega game. But if you're reading Donny Cates Thor, I don't think this is a must. From what I can see, from what I haven't been reading Donny Cates Thor, but from what I know of his run on Thor and what I've seen and what I've heard, this doesn't sound like it's some must read. But I could easily see Cates maybe pulling something out of this story to use later on, because that's just, he does those kind of things. So I guess if you're a big fan of Donny Cates and a big fan of his run on Thor, you probably want to pick this up. But you better get to your comic shop early and hope they ordered enough copies. So, this book is kind of indicative of what I was saying about how it's kind of a mediocre week on the stands. It's not terrible, but it's not memorable either. You know, I'm not going to be thinking about this comic, you know, 2 months from now. So, what do you have up next, Manny?
Speaking of mediocre books, I have, no offense, Red Hood Outlaw, number 49. Still chugging along. Scott Lobdell, writer, with Paolo Pantanella, artist, and Arif Prianto as a colorist. And then Troy Pietri as with the letters, as always. It looks like we're reaching the end of this book, obviously. They've had their conversation with Trigon, and that's something that Bizarro took care of the issue before. So now they're kind of dealing with trying to close the door to hell. What makes it strange is that the resolve is that they're going to be helped by another Red Hood Outlaws team from the past. So they kind of work together for this. And I don't really want to spoil much about it, because this kind of is the some of the climatic moments of the book. So I'm not going to say too much about it, but I feel like the way it's wrapping up, it's a little bit sloppy. And I think what bothers me also is, not that I have not enjoyed the character development of Bizarro, but he's kind of been elevated to being so much like brighter than what he usually is in anything else, that it almost seems like a different character. And I understand that if the story's wrapping up, then whatever, do what you want, and make him seem however you like. But if you took this character now and you show it to somebody else, it doesn't read Bizarro at all. And even with the way he talks, like he says in one section, no context, so you know not to really spoil anything, but he says Bizarro's made its decision, Bizarro's going to stay. And it's just third person. Usually he says the opposite of things, but in this case he's actually meaning what he says, and so it's very difficult. I had a difficult time with it just because it just seemed out of place. And then with the two teams on the same book, and then everything just kind of wraps up like super neat and kind of quick. And I felt that for an ending, for something that's close to an end, I felt that this book in particular falls flat. And not to say I love the artwork on it. I love the way that Bizarro's drawn. Just the detail in the tone and the muscles, there's that page where he says the words that I just mentioned. I think he looks fantastic. And I like the way also the colors in the book are very vibrant. There's not much else I can say about this book, other than Just given what good of a run it's been, and even some weird moments which worked for it, I think this one just didn't feel like enough for me.
Yeah, I mean, it happens sometimes, you know. Like Liddell's been on that book for a long, long time, so it's kind of sad to hear that it's losing its consistency, but I wonder how much he's just like ready to be done with it. So you just wonder. All right. Well, let me move on to my next book, another Marvel title. And I'm going to talk about this one real briefly. I'm not going to run down the list of creators because it's Giant Size X-Men, the tribute to Len Wein. And basically what this book is, it's a reprint of Giant Size X-Men number one. You know, that would be the first appearance of Storm and Nightcrawler and Colossus. You know, it's a super famous cover. Warpath, his first appearance as well. And, you know, the original one, Len Wein and Dave Cockrum. And what they've done is they've recreated it. And it's not a straight reprint. I mean, the book's been reprinted, you know, a bunch of times in different trades. And I think they even did a True Believers or a facsimile edition. But what they've done this time as a tribute to Len Wein is all 36 pages of this book are from a different artistic team. So page one is Alex Ross, page two is Kevin Nolan, and so on and so forth. So it's their interpretation. They try to keep things the same in the panels, like the layouts of the panels, in terms of what happens in those panels. They're not exactly, you know, like line by line, but they're pretty similar. Like when you flip through, it's interesting because, you know, some of these styles of artwork are very similar to each other. And so when you flip from one page to the other, it's a big, like, whoa, that's, you know, super different. But you still recognize, you know, the if you've ever read Giant Size X-Men number one, you'll recognize the layouts of these panels. You're like, oh yeah, I remember that panel. I remember that scene. It looks exactly the same, just drawn by a different person, you know, a different style. So I didn't actually read it. I just went through and stared at the art and remembered, because, you know, I've read it so many times. The two pages that stood out for me, there's a Mark Brooks page. And if you've ever read Giant Size X-Men number one, Cyclops goes out and recruits these people, or Professor X reaches out and recruits these people and these new X-Men. And then all of a sudden you turn the page and it's like chapter two, and it's a scene inside the X-Mansion, and they're all in their costumes, these new characters, and it's like a splash page. And it, again, they're just like all standing there looking cool. Like as soon as I turned to this page, I was like, I knew immediately it was Mark Brooks. I'm like, wow, that is just, like, I love Mark Brooks' art, man. He's such a great artist. And so I was really blown away by that page. And I thought my first thought was, man, I would love to own that original piece of art. Not that I could ever afford it. It'd probably be like $5,000, but yeah, it looks awesome. The other page that really stood out to me when I was flipping through it, I think it was page, I'm trying to find it real fast. I want to say page 32. And it's Jen Bartel. And, you know, I haven't seen Jen. Like, she does cover work for Marvel, and she's got her her series that she does with Sam Humphries over at Image called Blackbird. But that's, you know, more magic and fashion and stuff. It's not like straight superhero. It was cool to see her draw the X-Men. The page that she draws has Storm and Polaris and Cyclops and Havoc. And I was like, wow, that's really good. So I really enjoyed it. Those are my two favorite pages. So if you're a big fan of the X-Men and you want to see this classic, you know, X-Men issue through the eyes of different artists, I mean, there's, you name a Marvel artist that's like popular or good, they're in here. You know, I mentioned a few of them: Steven Segovia, Marguerite Savage, Bernard Chang, Aaron Cutter. I mentioned Mark Brooks already, Phil Noto, Chris Anka, Linnell Francis Yu, Emmanuel Lupacino is in here. RB Silva, Ramon Rosanos has a really good page. Marco Cicchetto. I mean, everybody who's anybody is in this book. So Yeah, pick it up, flip through it. It's probably worth your you know, your what, $5, I think it is, $6. And certainly if you don't own a copy of Giant Size X-Men, this is a great way to get the issue affordably. You know, if you're putting together a run of X-Men, here's a great way to, you know, you probably can't, or maybe you can, I don't know, but if you can afford to get, you know, an original Giant Size X-Men and spend, you know, $1,000 or whatever, here's a great way to pick up a reprint that's kind of unique and different. So pretty interesting. I had no idea what this was. I mean, I knew it was a tribute to Ween and Cochran, but I didn't know, like, was it a straight reprint, what they were doing? I didn't read up on it. But I opened it up and I was like, oh, it's a bunch of different artists. And here's another great thing about this book. Like, if you're somebody who goes to shows, conventions, and likes to get autographs, you can just carry around one book and have tons of people sign it, which is always really cool. You know, I mean, I probably couldn't get everybody. If you did, book would be worth a lot of money to have it signed by, you know, whatever this is, probably 50 people. Because on a lot of the pages you have two people, because you have the artist and then the color artist. And then some of them even have three because they have an inker as well. So that's something really cool that you could do with it as well. Just carry it around at different conventions and see how many of these artists you can get to sign the pages that they worked on. So definitely something cool and different. If you're an X-Men fan or a fan of different art styles, I definitely recommend checking it out. What do you have up next, Manny?
Man, you know what? I appreciate the segues you're throwing at me, man, because speaking about something different, my next book is from Image Comics, The Department of Truth Number 1, written by James Tynan, with art by Mark Simmons. This book is bananas. It's a fun conspiracy thriller. It follows a character named Cole Turner that has studied all types of conspiracy theories all his life. And we all know some of the popular ones, like the Earth's not round, it's actually flat. The JFK assassination was an inside job. Nobody ever really landed on the moon. I don't know. There's a bunch of them. Area 51, I guess you can call it. So in this book, the whole premise of it is these things are true. But there is a Men in Black type of organization for the government called the Department of Truth that takes care of keeping everything on the low and making sure that people's brains don't get overwhelmed with all of these quote-unquote truths. And Cole Turner actually, in his conspiracy, in his study of conspiracy theories, he goes to kind of like a convention type of deal where he meets more people like this and where he finds out that some of these things are true. And with that, that's when he gets picked up by the Department of Truth. And it's a very it's a little dense. The book's a little dense, I feel, just because there's a lot of reading to it. It actually, for me, it felt like there was a lot to get through, and it felt longer than the I think it's like 36 pages overall that it is, including the covers. And so when I kept going, I was like, man, there's more, which isn't necessarily a bad thing because I was enjoying it. But for a second, I thought, I was like, man, is this another one of these like one-shot stories where that I just did not pick up on, kind of like Joker War, where I opened it, I was like, oh, damn it, this is like 50 pages. And then no, it wasn't that much longer than a regular book, but there's so much in it that it takes a while to get through. And it also kind of gets you thinking a little bit because you know, these are, it's based on true events that a lot of people have debates on nowadays. And so, you know, and if some of it inspires that kind of thought process, then, you know, it makes it for a much better book than something that's more like I call a Capri Sun read that you just kind of flip through and get through it and get ready for the next one. The artwork by Simmons is really, really gritty. And there are some pages where it almost hurt my eyes just because of it. It looks distorted and it looks blurry and it, my eyes are trying to adjust to it, and it's not supposed to. And I'm trying to tell myself, like, no, that's what it looks like in my eyes. Like, no, focus. Like, no, I am focused. And so I think in some of these pages, the book did wonders for that visually, because, I mean, what better way to put it than the truth is blurry, quote unquote. Great use of art in the story there. So if you like that kind of stuff, like a conspiracy thriller, if you like to stuff like Amazon's new show Utopia, where a comic book is a conspiracy, this story is actually really fun to look at, really interesting, and I really want to see what happens in going forward with this. Where does Attinian take this? Tynan take this? Because it's got me hooked. It's fun.
Yeah, this is my book of the week. It was by far and away the best thing that I read out of the 15 titles that I read already this week. It really blew me away. When you get to the end and you find out who the head of the Department of Truth is, that's a big curve.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I didn't expect that. That was really cool. The artwork reminded me, I don't know if you read Cowl by Kyle Higgins. But the artwork there by Rod Rees, this is kind of that same style of artwork where, like Manny said, it's pretty gritty. It's like watercolor. But there's a lot of texture, like Mitch Gerrards does with a lot of his work. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of texture added in. So it's not my favorite style of art, because I usually prefer cleaner lines, but it definitely works for this type story. And the other thing that I wanted to shout out is that the letter Aditya Bidikar does an incredible job with the word balloons and the lettering that really helps to tell the story. Like Manny said, it's pretty dense. There's a lot of dialogue. There's a lot of caption boxes as, what did you say his name was? Cole? I can't remember. Cole, right?
Cole.
Yeah. He's kind of narrating. Cole. Yeah. He's recalling what happened to him at that convention and subsequent events to some other people. And so there's a lot of the pages where it's him narrating, and that can get boring, right? With that many words on the page. And Bidikar does a good job with the lettering of keeping it fresh and keeping your eye moving around the page. So yeah. This is one of those books where the worst part about it was as soon as I was done, even though it was 36 pages, and I didn't get that sense at all, Manny, I was sucked in and didn't even realize it was 36 pages until you said it. And I was like, I guess it was a pretty good chunk of story. But I was so sucked in, I devoured it and it was over. And I was like, man, I have to wait a month for the next issue. Especially because of that final page reveal where we find out who the head of the Department of Truth is, which was just a really, really cool idea. So James Tynan is a great writer. I'm a huge fan of his. So I can't wait to see what happens next in this book. So
yeah, and then something else that I really liked was the pacing was really, really good. There's not like a thought or an idea that they beat over with the hammer too much to kind of make you lose interest. You go back and forth from past events to present events in a good pacing where it's just enjoyable from first page to the last.
Yeah, now on to my next Marvel title, which I also found to be okay, not great. I guess if you're a fan, maybe you'll like it better than me, but it's Shang-Chi number one, Brothers and Sisters Part One from writer Jean Luen Yang. Art is by Dyke Ruan. Flashback artist is Philip Tan. Colorist is Sebastian Cheng, and letters are by Travis Lanham. I have never read any Shang-Chi. I know he's a beloved character for a lot of people. Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu from the 70s, Bronze Age. So I think it's been a long time coming for him to make his return to Marvel Comics. I don't even know the last time he showed up in a Marvel comic, but I just wasn't a fan. It the story's fine in terms of pacing and dialogue and everything. But I guess I don't know. I think there was a time in my life where I was a fan of martial artists and fighting and that kind of stuff, but I guess I'm not really anymore. It just didn't hold my interest. It was one of those books while I was reading it. I was like, okay, this can be over anytime. Like I almost didn't want to read it. So, and the artwork it's an interesting style, and I'm not familiar with Dyke Ruan at all. And so it's an interesting blending of East and West. You know, you can definitely tell he's got manga influences, but there's a lot more detail in his art than at least in some of the panels than you would expect in a typical manga comic. And I thought the action scenes were done really well also, but I don't know. I'm a fan of Gene Luen Yang. You know, he's been on the show a couple times. I loved what he did with the new Superman title. And when he was on, that was for DC Rebirth. And then when he was previously to Rebirth, when he was on Superman, I enjoyed that as well. But here, and don't get me wrong, I mean, I think he's a great choice. You know, he's got Asian ancestry. And so, you know, he probably knows a lot more about China and martial arts and their myths and culture than I do, certainly. And so he's probably pulling from a lot of that here when he's talking about these different factions that Fang Chi has to go up against and such. And so I suppose it's lending an authenticity to it, but it's just not something I'm interested in. So for me, it kind of fell flat. Honestly, the best thing about it, I thought, was the cover by Jim Chung, which was really cool looking cover with Shang-Chi and this like flaming dragon. So I normally say that I always read at least the first two issues of a book before I give up on it completely. So I will be reading the second issue to see if it pulls me in the way the first issue didn't. And we'll see. But I don't know. I'm almost done. I almost don't want to read the second issue, but I'll give it a try. So I think if you're a fan of Shang-Chi, you probably like it. But I know nothing about the character, and this didn't make me. It didn't grab me, so I'll just put it that way. What do you have up next, Manny?
My next book is Wonder Woman 763, and this is continued by Mariko Tamaki, with pencils by Carlo Barberi, and ink by Matt Santorelli, and colors by Alejandro Sanchez. It looks like it's a culmination of the Liar Liar story arc that they started telling in this kind of new style of Wonder Woman that they're doing with Tamaki. And I gotta say, it was kind of a letdown. I was with the first few issues when the character was introduced, and with the reintroduction of, well, I guess not introduction, but reappearance of Maxwell Lord, I was expecting a little bit more from it. I was, because, you know, Maxwell Lord is kind of like, you could say it's Wonder Woman's Lex Luthor. So even if he's working with her, you know that there's probably a knife somewhere hidden behind his back that he's going to stab her with at some point. And yeah, that's not really what happened at all. And I mean, I don't really want to give too much away about how everything gets resolved, but it just kind of ended. I feel like for a good story arc, something like this, especially where you're introducing a new character that has such connection to a character like a Maxwell Lord, I feel like there needs to be a little bit more, maybe more on the line as far as like a sacrifice or a heroic deed or something that a villain needs to do. But I mean, this just kind of it. It just happened, and now we're gonna move on. And I wish I can say, you know, more about it, that it was so great or something like that, because I really did feel like it started off on the right foot, and then it just felt this with this issue, I really felt like the entire arc kind of just falls flat. Then there's nothing really memorable about it, and that's really much I can say about it. It's unfortunate. I mean, I
super disappointing.
Nothing really happened.
Yeah, well, it ended the first.
Yeah,
ended,
yeah.
And I
yeah.
I remember how excited I was the first issue. We had that awesome Mikkel Janin art. We had Mariko Tamaki.
Yep.
And then, you know, a couple issues in, we get Carlo Barberi, and he's a fine artist. You know, he doesn't have the experience of Janin, and his art, in my mind, isn't as dynamic. And, you know, maybe he'll get there someday, but I'm a huge Mikkel Janin fan. That was part of the reason I was so excited. So, you know, feeling like I had the rug pulled out from under me, but thought the story was at least still going strong. But you're right. It doesn't come to a satisfying conclusion. It doesn't end with a bang the only thing you could say about it is, okay, well, so that ended. But it was like, you know, it wasn't so much that I was so bad that I felt like, what did I read that for? But it just, yeah, it was just disappointing. That's the best way you can even, like, even within the issue itself, when Wonder Woman is fighting Liar Liar, and then something happens with Maxwell Lord where he basically saves the day, but it's like super anticlimactic. It's not like he jumps her, or it just ends. It's like, it wasn't satisfying.
I didn't even get a rabbit fight
at all.
It you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
It's like it shapeshifts, and then nothing happens.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like Manny said, super super disappointing. And I was singing the praises of Mariko Tamaki and Mikkel Janin, and saying this was a great time to be on Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
Have the first arc end like this. I don't know. It just it's disappointing. So hopefully I'm gonna stick around for another arc and see how it goes. Hopefully it'll pick up some, and I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could say more about it, but there's nothing much I can say about it.
It's kind of disappointing. And again, you know, I'm a huge fan of Mariko, but here we are. You know, we're on the same page with these books, and it goes back to what I was saying, you know, earlier when we first started about how it's just kind of a disappointing week. Here's another great creator that I'm a huge fan of on this next book. It's Immortal Hulk, The Threshing Place. It's a one shot. It's written by Jeff Lemire. We have art by Mike Del Mundo, colors by Del Mundo and Marco D'Alfonso, and letters by Cordy Petit. And this, just like Wonder Woman, if you're a huge, huge, huge fan of Immortal Hulk and Jeff Lemire and Mike Del Mundo, I guess pick it up. But if you're reading Immortal Hulk and you only pick this up because it says the Immortal Hulk on this, you're wasting your money. It doesn't have anything to do, you know, you can skip this. It doesn't have anything to do with the story that's going on in Immortal Hulk, in terms of, you know, things that are going on over there with the leader and Doc Samson and, you know, the other gamma mutates, whatever. This doesn't tie in any way meaningfully where you need to read that story. This is one of those things where, and it's been happening more and more lately with Immortal Hulk, Marvel has a huge hit on their hands. And so just like they used to do back in the day where they would start a second series, like when we had two Black Panther series going on at the same time, three different Iron Man series going on. It's like, okay, Immortal Hulk sells, so let's put out as many books as we can on the sands that say the Immortal Hulk. The art by Del Mundo is okay, but not great. He's not really a good choice to do the kind of body horror that is in Immortal Hulk. And Lemire's story, it's like, okay, you read it and you're like, okay, that happened, whatever. You know, it's not, there's nothing to it. And maybe with a different art style would be more impactful, but it was one of those things. Yeah. It's like a really short read, probably read it in less than 10 minutes and immediately like forgot about it. Like there's nothing consequential to it whatsoever. It feels like just a total money grab. So I can't even advise anybody. Even if you're reading Immortal Hulk, I wouldn't buy this. Like I read Immortal Hulk. I don't think I ordered a copy, although I may have before I read it. Now that I think about it, I might have ordered one from my local comic shop. But I might just put it back on the rack because, I don't want to spend $5 on this. It's just not worth it. Definitely not. Can't recommend it at all. So not enough said about that. What do you have up next, Manny?
I have Batman Three Jokers number 2. Jeff Johns, writer, Jason Fabok, one of the best artists in the... Okay. All right. So I feel like issue 2 of Batman Three Jokers was better than the first. That is for sure. And, you know, the funny thing is that it has nothing to do with the Joker or the Jokers in the book. The real bright spot for this book has to be Jason Todd's Red Hood and Barbara Gordon's Batgirl. And her empathy for him and kind of diving deep into the issues that he has in the way that he feels that he was treated after his Joker encounter. But the problem is that everybody thought he was dead. So it's very difficult to help somebody when you don't even know they're alive. And that's the trauma that is explored in issue 2 of Batman Three Jokers. And I thought it was great. And so I think for me, that's what made this book good. I am still confused as far as what's the meaning of the multiple Jokers. And so if anything, the artwork, as always, and the colors by Brad Anderson, and then obviously just the artwork by Fabok, fantastic. I don't know what it is about having to watch Thomas and Martha Wayne get shot over and over again that has me so annoyed. And because now we're gonna something that is explored also in this book is Joe Chill, and for various reasons. And I think I mentioned it to you before a couple of weeks ago, just because some of these things are also explored in Joker War, and some of the individual books, Batman books, and it's just like, man, like, leave his parents alone for a couple of issues. And that kind of bothered me a little bit, not too much, but so into the story about Red Hood, about Jason Todd, about his psyche and how he's not necessarily tormented by what happened to him with the Joker, but what happened afterwards or what didn't happen. I thought that was great. That's really all I have to say about this book. But when it comes to that big Joker reveal or that dynamic Joker story that we've been promised for a couple of years, I still don't see it.
Yeah. You said you liked it so much better than the first issue. And I'm sitting here trying to think, did I like it? I will say this. I think that the second issue is paced a lot better. I didn't realize how much I thought the first issue was kind of choppy in terms of pacing until I read this one, and it flows narratively a lot better. I think the first one is kind of fits and starts, where this one flows much, much better. But yeah, I finished it and I thought, well, that was enjoyable, but now we're two issues in, we're two through the story, and we still have zero answers about the Joker. If anything, I have even more questions. And now it seems like it's going back to something I said when we talked about the first issue, where we're starting to get hints that, okay, so maybe there is one person isn't the Joker. The Joker's like a totem or like an evil spirit. It's not actually what the story is saying, but it's like this evil persona, let's say, that, you know, you infect somebody with the Joker toxin, and if they quote unquote have what it takes, to become a Joker, they become a Joker. And so the Joker isn't any one person. It's this subversive persona ideal. I absolutely hate that. Like, no, the Joker, like the fact that they're, I mean, I don't like, we all know I don't like the Joker. So what's right. worse than the Joker? Two Jokers. What's worse than two Jokers? Three Jokers.
Three Jokers.
Enough. Enough with the damn Jokers. I don't need any more Jokers. And I certainly don't need the Joker as some idea of this immortal totem that's passed down from person to person to person. I absolutely hate that idea. And if that's what this is, it's going to be a story that I don't like. I won't go so far as to call it a failure, but so far I'm not feeling it because, you know, like you were saying, we've been anticipating this for years, right? With
right.
ever since Batman got that information from the Mobius chair. And then, you know, don't even get me started on why it doesn't make sense that he never followed up on, you know, on this. And he's had interactions with the Joker, you know, multiple times since then. And now we're finally getting this Joker story. But like you said, it hasn't even really been a Joker story. Kind of a little bit of Joker setup in the first issue. But like Manny said, this issue is all about Red
Hood. Todd. Mm-hmm.
So I would almost say with that context, probably if you go back and read the first issue, knowing that the second issue really focuses on Jason Todd, it's going to turn out that you should have called this story like Batman Red Hood or something, you know, like it's going to be turn out to be a Red Hood story and about Jason's redemption. So yeah, and there were some other problems I had with the issue based on what Jason Todd did at the end of last issue. And Batman, I easily could see a Batman, somebody writing a Batman story where Jason Hood did this thing and now he's laser focused on, I got to take him down. Isn't that what happened when Jason Hood shot the Penguin?
Yeah. Batman was there real quick.
Yeah. And now he does what he does in the first issue and Batman's just kind of like, I'll talk to him. Like, what?
Yeah, like, what? Sure. He's been through a lot. Chill.
What? So, yeah, it's... And, I mean, again, I'm a Geoff Johns fan. But this is not clicking for me. That being said, I do recommend you pick this up, if only to look at the pretty pictures, because...
Great.
Jason Fabok, next level. He has said it's the best work of his career. I have to agree. Absolutely spectacular work from him, so...
Well, I mean, also, just to get that kind of... to get that Jason Todd aftermath story about, you know, just the reason why he's so resentful. That's why it's also good, but it's not the Joker story.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's why I liked it. But then at the end of it, I was kind of like, am I being bamboozled here? Because if you recall in the interview, in the pre-interviews for this book, it says that it was going to be, there's going to be a lot about Bruce Wayne, Jason Todd and Barbara Gordon. So is issue 3 now going to be the same thing, but now we're going to flip it with Barbara? And so where does that leave this whole epic Joker story in issue 4? Yeah, I don't know, man.
There's only 3 issues. I feel like we've got any Batman in the story.
So. Yeah. This entire issue was just Batman, listening to Batgirl rant about everything that Red Hood did. That's all he really did.
Yeah. So I don't know. Well, let me go ahead and talk about the last book that I want to mention. It's Dark Knight's Death Metal Multiverse's End, written by James Tynan. We have art. Let me find it here. I think it's at the end probably. This was, they could have called this Dark Knight Death Metal, Owlman is what they could have called it. Cause it was all Owlman. I can't find the credits. Sorry. But I did finally get caught up on Dark Knight's Death Metal. And, this is basically a 2-part story. And the second part I think is coming out, I want to say on October 13th. There's I think it's a Death Metal New Gods story where we're going to get the second half of this. And despite kind of a choppy start to Dark Knight's death metal, I've actually been kind of enjoying it now that I'm caught up. So what I didn't necessarily enjoy about this issue was the art. Thought it's just kind of, it's a little lazy. But I will say that the reason I wanted to talk about it and mention it, I think Tynan, the writer, does a great job of kind of summing up. There's the credit. So James Tynan, writer, Juan Gedeon, artist, Mike Spicer on colors, Russ Wooten on letters. But Tynan does a great job. There's a scene with John Stewart Green Lantern where he's talking to Owlman, and Owlman is trying to understand. Like, he's asking Owlman for help, and Owlman's like, well, why should I help you? You know, you got to fill me in. Because again, remember, Owlman is a version of Bruce Wayne. So, you know, he's going to want the details so he can form his opinion. He can think, he can make a plan like Batman always does, like Bruce Wayne always does. And so John Stewart starts explaining, well, here's what I know of what's going on right now. And so I feel like even if you're not reading death metal, if you're a newer DC fan and you just kind of want to understand the nature of the DC universe in the way that these crises have happened, this is really an issue you should read. And when I started out, like when Stewart first starts explaining and he starts talking about the first crisis, like Tynan does a great job of summing that up. Like, here's what the DC universe was, and then here's why the first crisis happens. And again, tying this all into what's been happening with Perpetua, what's been happening with the Batman Who Laughs. So, you know, really pulling from all the stuff that Scott Snyder has been building at DC over the last couple of years. And Tynan does a great job of having John Stewart Green Lantern explain that to us as readers, and really puts it in a really easy to understand way. And so when I read that, I was like, oh, that is awesome. That's a great way to explain it. You're really simplifying it. That's really cool. And then I thought, oh, and he's going to keep going, right? Like, because then we switch scenes to some other heroes and they're doing their thing. And then we switch back to Green Lantern. So I thought, okay, now we're going to get more of the story. Unfortunately, I don't know if it was an issue of space, they did not having enough room, or if they just feel like the subsequent crises, which that would be Zero Hour and Infinite Crisis and Final Crisis, aren't as important. But he didn't go into the same like detail. He basically doesn't explain them at all, other than, and then this happened, like Parallax caused something, and then some survivors of the original multiverse caused another crisis, and then Darkseid caused a crisis, and then we had Barbados come from the dark multiverse. So Zero Hour, Infinite Crisis, Final Crisis, and the first Metal series aren't really explained at all, which that was a little bit of a disappointment, because Crisis on Infinite Earth was explained so well. So I mean, I still think, just for that, if you're a kind of a newer reader to DC, or you came in after and you're not like this huge DC nut that really understands the way everything ties together, I think this issue, and particularly that part of the issue, is worth reading to kind of understand. Certainly if you're reading death metal and you didn't read any of that stuff, again, you're going to get a lot out of this and be like, okay, this is the way everything fits together. I just wish that Tynan had been able to kind of give us a little more detail on those other crises to kind of explain them in the same way, because he did such a good job with the original crisis. It was a little disappointing to see him gloss over the subsequent ones so quickly. So it was a little bit of a letdown, but I know I'm nitpicking because he does such a great job of explaining the first one. So yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. There are plenty of things about death metal that I'm not enjoying. I think that Snyder and Capullo, for all their talent, are kind of, they're throwing everything but the kitchen sink in there, you know, and it feels messy and unnecessary. And I think it could be narratively, it could be a lot tighter if they weren't trying to do all these quote unquote cool things like a Batmo Beast, I think it's called. Like, it's literally Batman merged with the Batmobile. we got Batman merged with the T-Rex. We've got a Bat Baby. We've got a Batman merged with a castle. Like, to me, those ideas are just dumb and stupid. They don't really work. They've taken some of the coolest things about metal, which was Batman merged with these, you know, cool heroes like villains, Doomsday and Flash and Green Lantern and Aquaman. And they've taken it a bridge too far for me. They've crossed a line where it doesn't make it fun or interesting. It just makes it kind of lame. So, but the core story I think is still interesting. You know, it's the idea of the Batman who laughs, basically leveling up to the point where he's, wants to be an equal or even more powerful than Perpetua and take her spot. And the idea of the heroes trying to fight that off. And probably the one outrageous idea that I do really like, well, two, I love Batman with the Black Lantern ring controlling zombies. And then the fact that Wonder Woman built a chainsaw and the chain is her lasso. It's just really, really cool. So, I know a lot of people haven't been enjoying death metal or think it's just a mess, and it does have its problems. Don't get me wrong, but I'm in based on how much I didn't care about the first issue and just felt indifferent about it, and like it was kind of lame. I'm surprised how much I'm kind of enjoying what's been going on. So, all right, Matt, you have one more book to talk about?
Do I?
I don't know. Do you?
I don't think so.
I felt like you had five and I had five, but maybe I'm wrong. You talked about Wonder Woman. You talked about Three Jokers. You talked about Red Hood Outlaw. Oh yeah. Cause you went first. That's why. Yeah. You went first with Joker War. So you already talked about all 5 years. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let me go ahead and give a rundown on some other books that you might want to be on the lookout for today. As you hear your comic shop from Aftershock Comics, we have from Stephanie Phillips, part five of her Artemis and the Assassins series, which I've talked about on the podcast before. Over at Boom, if you missed We Only Find Them When They're Dead from Al Ewing, the first two times it was in the shop, we've got a third printing hitting stands today, and Wind from James Tynan has a second printing of the first issue in comic shops today. I also did read the Batman Superman Annual number one, which is basically Batmite and Mixel Piddalick, Mr. Mixes Piddalick fighting over who would win in a fight between Batman and Superman. And while that sounds kind of cool, it kind of in line with the theme of the week, it ended up being pretty mediocre. We also have Harley Quinn and the Birds of Prey at number three from Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor. We've got Cy Spurrier's John Constantine Hellblazer number 10, which is just getting rave reviews, but has already been canceled. We've got Legion of Superheroes number 9. That kind of like the giant X-Men tribute issue is a bunch of different artists doing like a page or 2 pages a piece. But I'm way behind on Legion of Superheroes, so I haven't read it. But you may want to check that out because there's a lot of great artists in there. We also have a Justice League Annual number 2 from Robert Venditti and Aaron Lopresti. I did enjoy it, but it wasn't either of their best work. I'm used to a little more dynamic artwork from Lopresti. It wasn't terrible, but I just didn't feel like it was his best work. And as far as the story goes, it was kind of by the numbers, you know, and I saw Robert Venditti back on Justice League, even if it was only for an issue. I was kind of excited and I don't know. It was a cool idea, but it just didn't hit the mark for me. So there's also a Wonder Woman 1984 special that, you know, obviously the movie was supposed to be out by now, and this version of Wonder Woman is kind of based on the Gal Gadot version. But again, it wasn't that great. It was Brett Blevins' art, and the artwork is kind of pedestrian. And I get you're trying to make the art look commercially viable or very appealing to provide, you know, a broad audience, a wide variety of people. And so it ended up only being okay. Wasn't anything special about it at all. So it was a little disappointing there. Over at Image, in addition to Department of Truth number one, we've got Mirko Aldofo's series Mercy, her creator-owned title, with issue 6 of 6. So that's coming to a close. And then we have the latest issue with Spawn, number 310, written by good old Todd McFarlane. Over at Marvel, Avengers number 36 starts a new story arc for that title, written by Jason Aaron. We've also got the second issue of Marvel Zombies Resurrection and the fifth issue of Marvel's X. Savage Avengers 12 is on stands, as well as X-Factor number 4. And then finally, I'll mention from Titan Comics, there's a Star Wars The Mandalorian, the Art and Imagery Collected Edition. So if you're a big fan of the Mandalorian TV show, you may want to check that out. It's only $20 for the hardcover, and it's got a bunch of our artwork and pictures and such from the TV show. So I got a chance to take a look at that, and it looked pretty cool. I haven't watched The Mandalorian. I'm not a big Star Wars fan these days, but I did want to give that a shout out. So I think that's going to do it. Again, last week was so great, and we were really spoiled for a lot of good books, and this week was much less so, but it happens, especially when there's, for whatever reason, when there's 5 Wednesdays in a month, it's like the last Wednesday can be kind of lacking. But that being said, don't sleep on Department of Truth. It was absolutely fantastic, and it's going to be one of those books. If you don't pick up the first issue, you're going to, you know, end up having to get a second or third print, and be disappointed that everybody's talking about it, everybody's reading it, but you know, I'll put it up there with like Gideon Falls in terms of how excited I am for the series after reading just one issue. And I could easily see this, just like Gideon Falls, getting option for a TV show. So can't wait to see where it goes next. So as always, you want to add something else, Manny?
Yeah, no, so I'm just double checking. That's your book of the week, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like without question, it was great. The only other book I may have given some consideration also by James Tynan, if that DC Multiverse one shot, if he had the space or had explained the other crises perfectly, the way he explained Crisis on Infinite Earths in it, then maybe there would have been a Department of Truth, and that I would have had a harder time choosing between the two. But being that he only explained one of the crises and kind of glossed over the rest, it's good but not great. Whereas Department of Truth is great. Like, yeah, even, and that's even with that style of artwork that I don't really care for, I still think it's absolutely fantastic. So anyway, that's going to do it for this episode. As always, want to thank everybody for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.